we have a real treat tonight with visiting writer Jim Shepherd. He's the author of 4 collections of short stories, most recently You Think That's Bad, and 7 novels now, including The Book of Aaron, which will be released next month by Knopf. He has published stories in all the places you want to publish them, and these stories have an astonishing range of voices, an impressive sweep of history, geography, and emotion. It's amazing how far-ranging his work is, amazing that one mind can comprehend so many disparate parts for which he's deeply admired by so many discerning readers and writers. He teaches at Williams College on the other side of Massachusetts, where he lives with his wife, the author Karen Shepherd, and their family. Please join me in welcoming Jim Shepherd.
Hi.
Hi.
The really unexcited hi came from my wife. I don't know if you're dead. It was like, hi. I've already said hi to you. Thanks, Matt. I'm going to read from that new novel Matt was talking about, which is indeed called The Book of Aaron. I've always been interested in children and catastrophe and ethical passivity, and this new thing seems to want to bring those three together under maximum pressure. As you'll hear, it's set in Poland, before and mostly during World War II, and mostly in the Warsaw Ghetto. So there'll be a lot of laughs, as you might expect. I'm going to read from the beginning, which means you'll be happy to hear that there is absolutely nothing I need to tell you in advance. My mother and father named me Aaron, but my father said they should have named me What Have You Done? And my uncle told everyone they should have called me What Were You Thinking? I broke medicine bottles by crashing them together and let the neighbor's animals loose from pens. My mother said my father shouldn't beat such a small boy, but my father said that one misfortune was never enough for me. And my uncle told her that my kind of craziness was like stealing from the rest of the family. When I complained about it, my mother reminded me that I had only myself to blame, and that in our family the cure for a toothache was to slap the other side of your face. My older brother was always saying we all went without cradles for our backsides or pillows for our heads. Why didn't he complain some more, my mother suggested. Maybe she could light the stove with his complaints. My uncle was my mother's brother, and he was the one who started calling me Shmaya because I did so many things that made him put his finger to his nose as a warning and say, God has heard. We shared a house with another family in Panevėžys near the Lithuanian border. We lived in the front room with a 4-paned window and a big stove and a tin sheet on top. Our father was always off looking for money. For a while, he sold animal hides. Our mother wished he would do something else, but he always said the Pope and the peasant each had their own work. She washed other people's floors, and when she left for the day, our neighbors did whatever they wanted to us. They stole our food and threw our things into the street. Then she came home exhausted and had to fight with them about how they treated us, while I hid behind the rubbish pile in the courtyard. When my older brothers got home, they'd be part of the shouting too. Where's Shmaya? They'd ask when it was all over. I'd still be behind the rubbish pile. When the wind was strong, grit got in my eyes. Shmaya only looks out for himself, my uncle always said. But I never wanted to be like that. I lectured myself on walks. I made lists of ways I could improve. Years went by like one unhappy day. My mother tried to teach me the alphabet, unsuccessfully. She used a big paper chart attached to a board and pointed to a bird or a little man or a person and to the letter that went with them. A whole day was spent trying to get me to draw the semicircle and straight line of the letter Aleph. But I was like something that had been raised in the wild. I didn't know the names of objects. Teachers talked to me and I stared back. My last SCADA results before we moved reported my conduct was unsatisfactory, my religion unsatisfactory, my arithmetic unsatisfactory, and even my wood and metal shop work unsatisfactory. My father called it the most miserable report he had ever seen, and he invited us all to figure out how I had pulled it off. My mother said I might have been getting better in some areas. And he told her that if God gave me a second or third life, I'd still understand nothing. He said a person with strong character could correct his path and start again, but a coward or a weakling could not. I always wondered if others had the same difficulty in learning. I always worried what would become of me because I couldn't do anything at all. It was terrible to have to be the person I was. I spent rainy days building dams in the street to divert the runoff. I found boards and pushed them along puddles with sticks. My mother dragged me out of the storms, saying when she found me that there I sat with my dreams full of fish and pancakes. She said while she bundled me into bed next to the stove that I'd never avoided an illness. From chicken pox to measles to scarlet fever to whooping cough, and that was why I'd spent my whole life 99% dead. That night I lay waiting for sleep like our neighbor's dog waited for passing wagons. When she heard me still awake, my mother would come to my bedside, even as tired as she was. To help me sleep, she said that if I squeezed my eyelids tight, lights and planets would float down past them, though I'd never be able to count them before they disappeared. She said that her grandfather told her that God moved those lights and planets with his little finger. I told her I was sorry for the way I was, and she said she wasn't worried about school, only about how I was with my family and our neighbors. She said that too often my tongue worked, but not my head, or my head worked, but not my heart. Yet, when my younger brother was born, I told her I wanted him thrown into the chicken coop. I was glum that whole year when I was 4 because of an infected vaccination on my arm. My mother said I played alone even when other kids were about. 2 years went by without my learning a thing. I didn't know how to swim or ride a bicycle. I had no grandparents, no aunts, and no godparents. When I asked why, my father said it was because society's parasites ate well while the worthy received only dirty water. And my mother said it was because of sickness. I attended cheder until my father came back from one of his trips and told my mother that it was 1936 and time for me to get a modern education. I was happy to change, since our teacher always had food in his beard and caned us across the fingers for wrong answers, and his house smelled like a kennel. So instead I went to public school, which was cleaner all around. My father was impressed that my new teacher dressed in the European style, and after he taught me to read, I started teaching myself. Since I was bored and knew no one, I took to books. And in public school, I met my first friend, whose name was Yudel. I liked him. Like me, he had no future. He was always running somewhere with his nose dripping. We made rafts to put in the river and practiced long-distance spitting. He called me Shmaya too, and I called him Pisher. When he wasn't well-behaved, he was clever enough to keep the teachers from catching on. One morning before anyone arrived, we played tip cat so violently we broke some classroom windows. We scared the boys who had nice satchels and never went barefoot. He was always getting me into trouble at home. And one Sabbath I was beaten for taking apart the family scissors so I could have two little swords for him and for me. His mother taught him only sad songs, including one about the king of Siberia before she got sick because of her teeth and died. He came looking for me once she was dead, but I hid from him. He told me the next day that two old men carried her out of the house on a board, and then his father moved him away. That summer, a card arrived for my father from his cousin in Warsaw, telling him there was work in his factory. The factory made fabric out of cotton thread. My father hitched a ride to the city in a truck full of geese and then sent for us. He moved us to 21 Zamenhofer Street, apartment number 6. My mother had us each memorize the address so we could find it when we got lost. And my younger brother, who had a bad lung, spent his days at the back window looking out at the garbage bins. We both thought the best thing about the move was the tailor shop across the square. The tailor made uniforms for the army. And in the front of his window, there were 3 rows of hand-sized mannequins, each dressed in miniature uniforms. We especially loved the tiny service ribbons. Because it was summer, I was expected to work at the factory so far away, we had to ride the trolley. I was shut up in a little room with no windows and four older boys and set to finishing the fabrics. The bolts had to be scraped until they acquired a grain like you found on winter stockings. Each of them took hours, and someone small as me had to lean his chest onto the blade to scrape with enough force. On hot days, sweat ran off me like rain off a roof. The other boys said things like, "What a fine young man from the country we now have in our midst. He's clearly going to be a big wheel in town." And I thought, am I only here so they can make fun of me? And I refused to go back. And my father said he would give me such a beating that it would hurt to raise my eyebrows. But while I sat there, like a mouse under the broom, my mother stopped him and said there was plenty I could do at home, and school was beginning in a few weeks anyway. My father said I'd only been given a partial hiding, and my mother told him that would do for now. And that night, once they started snoring, I crept to their beds and kissed her goodnight and pulled the blanket from his feet so maybe he'd catch a chill. Because I couldn't sleep, I helped her with the day's first chores, and she told everyone she was lucky to have a son who didn't mind rising so early. I worked hard and kept her company. I emptied her wash buckets and fetched hot compresses from my brother's chest. She asked if this wasn't much better than breaking bottles and getting into trouble, and I told her it was. I was still so small, I could squat and ride the bristled block of the long-handled brush she used to polish the floors. When she told my father that at least now their children were better behaved, he told her not one of us looked either well-fed or good-tempered. He joked at dinner that she cooked like a washerwoman. "Go to a restaurant," she said in response. She later told me when she was young, she never complained, so her mother would always know who her best child was and keep her near. So I became myself only once the lights went out, and in the mornings, went back to pretending things were okay. At our new school, we sat not at one filthy table, but on real school benches. I wanted more books, but had no money for them, and when I tried to borrow them from my classmates, they said no. I dealt with bullies by not fighting until the bell for class was about to be rung. When my mother complained to my teacher that a classmate had called me a dirty Jew, my teacher said, "Well, he is, isn't he?" And from then on, she made me take weekly baths. I stayed at that school until another teacher twisted a girl's ear until he tore it. And then my mother moved me back to a cheder where they also taught Polish, two trolley stops away. But I still shrank from following instruction like a dog from a stick. My new teacher asked my mother what anyone could do with a kid who was so full of answers. "He's like a fox, this one," he said. "He's 8 going on 80. And when she reported the meeting to my father, he gave me another hiding. That night, she came to my bedside and sat and asked me to explain myself, and at first, I couldn't answer, and then I finally told her that I had figured out that most people didn't understand me and that those who did wouldn't help. My two older brothers got jobs outside of town, driving goats to the slaughterhouse, and were gone until after dark. And like my father, they thought my mother should stay at home. So she confided in me about her plan to expand her laundry business. She said it was no gold mine, but it could be a serious help, especially before Passover and Rosh Hashanah. She told me she used some of their hidden savings to buy soap and bleach in barrels, and that every time my father passed their money's hiding place, she had a block of ice under her skull and could feel every hair on her head. I said, why shouldn't she take the money? And she was so happy, she told me that once I turned 9, she would make me a full partner. And this made me happy, because I knew that once I had enough money, I would run away to Palestine or Africa. The week before Passover, we set giant pots of water to boil on the stove, and we pushed all the bed linens and garments we collected from her customers into two barrels with metal rims, and she lathered everything with a yellow block of soap before we rinsed it all and ran it through a wringer and dragged all that wet laundry and baskets up to the attic, where she'd strung ropes in every direction under the rafters. Since we opened the windows for the cross breezes, She couldn't rest that night and whispered to me about gangs that specialized in crossing rooftops to steal laundry. So I slept up there so that she could relax. "See, you don't only care about yourself," she whispered when she came to wake me the next morning. And she put her mouth to my forehead and her hand to my cheek. When she touched me like that, it was as if the person everyone hated had flown away. And while he was gone, I didn't let her know that I was already awake. I did kindnesses for my mother, but she always wanted me to do them instead for my little brother. He was afraid of everything. She kept a lit candle near his bed to drive shadows out of corners because his window had no shutters. And at night, he always thought someone was standing beside it outside or knocking on the wall, and he cried himself to sleep about it. When she went to comfort him, his eyes were so full of fear it scared me to look at them. Our father shouted at him to stop, which made things worse. He reminded my brother that everyone in the building understood that parents didn't need to hold back and could give rule breakers what they deserved. He'd work himself up about it, and then our mother would placate him in the other room after telling me to stay with my brother and do what I could to calm him down. My brother had all sorts of medicines and drops and inhaler pots on the bedside table, and my mother taught us how to grab his head and tilt it forward when he had trouble breathing and started to choke. He hated being inside all the time, and finally ran away and left a note saying he'd had enough of this life, and he was missing for 2 days. Once he was back, my mother locked him in the apartment, and he pulled his chair to the window so he could see outside. I didn't understand him, but liked the blank way he didn't complain. He cupped any treat he was given in his hands and peeked at it before passing it along to one of us. If he wasn't napping or staring out his window, he stayed near my mother. When he got angry, he didn't hit anyone or shout, but instead went for days without speaking. My mother had a saying about how quiet he got, that his wisdom died inside of him, something her own mother had said about her. She told the neighbors that as a toddler, he'd once laid himself spread-eagled on the trolley tracks to prevent her from leaving, and she'd had to carry him home, and that when she'd asked him about it afterwards, he'd put his hands over her mouth. The kids on my block reacted to my lack of interest with their own. Sometimes they threw stones at me. Another whole summer came and went. I wanted to learn how to ride a bicycle, so I went to a boy who owned one, and he said he would teach me. I could get on by myself after the first lesson, but then he wouldn't teach me anymore. I met Lutek one evening when I sat near some kids I didn't know, and they told me to leave, and I didn't. He had a rabbit skin cap with ear flaps, and when one of the kids asked where he got it, he said he'd found it between the kid's mother's legs, and they started pushing him around. They knocked him into me, so I shoved the kid who'd done it, and he landed on his back and head on the paving stones. The other kids chased us, and Lutek led me into a cellarway hidden by a coal chute, and they all ran by. I asked him how he'd found it, and he said he'd been hiding since before I was born. While we sat there in the dark, I asked him more questions, but he stopped answering and just sniffed at the air like a dog. He was even smaller than me. He was so small, he said he had a younger sister who everyone thought was older. He said the village he was from was pitiful. It didn't appear on maps, and it was just 3 lanes of cottages, fences, and mud. He'd gone to school for 1 year at the Talmud Toyas on Miwa Street, which he said was famous for graduating ignoramuses. He said his father was the strongest porter in the city and pulled a handcart he harnessed to himself like a horse. He was especially good with the huge machinery crates from Lourdes that 3 men had trouble budging. Otherwise, he sat in a tavern. He worked at the railroad station near Yavuzevsky's courtyard. My mother was happy I'd made a friend, but soon upset that I was never around to watch my younger brother once Lutek took charge of my education. He showed me how to steal from the vegetable carts and how one of us, by making a commotion, could hide what the other was doing, even when the peddlers were watching out for one another. With a French pamphlet he took from a bookstall, he proved I didn't know anything about girls, and discovered I knew so little I didn't even know what he was talking about. And after he had cursed some filthy Russians, he also said that I didn't know anything about politics which was also true. He taught me that no one else's problems should get in the way of our having a good time. I told him about all the trouble I'd gotten into with Udall, including the broken school windows, but he was unimpressed. His family had moved 3 times since coming to Warsaw, and in one neighborhood he'd been hauled in by the police for breaking down the door of a boy who'd stolen his cap, and in another for having put a hole in a kid's head with a jeweler's hammer. He said the kid was okay after a while, though he'd had to wear a head bandage and everyone had called him the Sheik. I asked if his father beat him for such offenses, and he said he'd had more luck with his father's strap since he'd learned to rub garlic and onion onto the welts. And that he was lucky that his father was more upset about his sister's stutter. His father tried to cure it by mimicking her, to shame her into getting over it. She liked me because when I had to wait for her to finish what she was saying, I never got impatient. She told Lutek that I was kind and he should bring me around more often. So he had me talk to her while he slipped money from her secret hiding spot. He said she knew he stole from her, but she never complained about it. When he took enough, we would buy sausages and ride the trolley. On those days I was around, and my younger brother was feeling better, my mother ordered me to take him to the park so he could get some fresh air. He was always thrilled to go. The back courtyard with the garbage bins got no light and was deserted except for the occasional stray cat. Lutek always found us wherever we went. He said that being saddled with a consumptive wasn't the end of the world and that we could always find some uses for him. So one day we persuaded him to steal a jar of jam and on another to sing to a policeman. Or else we went about our business and he followed along. Whenever Lutek saw his blank look, he asked him, "So how's the weather in Vilno?" A joke my younger brother never understood. On our way home, I told my younger brother not to tell our mother about whatever we had done. And then she said he had to, so he did, and I wouldn't get supper that night. Then after he went to sleep, she would sit at the foot of my bed, and we'd look at each other. Neither of us would speak until she finally asked me to try to remain a decent human being, and then kissed my cheek before wishing me good night. And I would look up at the ceiling in the darkness and remember that I gave her nothing in return for what she gave me and almost never had. And then I would plan my next day with Lutek. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you. That was great. And it's available next month. And we have some other books available over here, some short stories. So thank you all very much.
Thank you. Thank you.